National news from a grassroots perspective. You're listening to Groundwire, community radio news from coast to coast to coast. This episode of Groundwire is produced by CKET on traditional Mohawk territory in Montreal. I'm your host, Tiffany Lam.
And I'm Dewa Hernandez. In this edition,
we're going to talk about terrorism based on the very root of its meaning. Then the first people they should be going after under Bill C-51 is the Harper government.
But first, here are the headlines.
The annual Israeli Apartheid Week kicked off in 26 countries around the world last week, including nearly a dozen cities across Canada. The event, which is organized mostly by students on university campuses, aims to raise awareness around the boycott, divestment, and sanctions, or BDS movement, against the State of Israel and in solidarity with the Palestinian people. Keynote speakers at several Canadian universities included Black liberation activist Sherelle Brown speaking about police brutality from Ferguson to Palestine, as well as Indigenous writer and academic Glenn Coulthard. In the past year, several student unions representing tens of thousands of members have passed BDS motions to boycott Israel, including the Ontario branch of the Canadian Federation of Students and the Concordia Student Union in Montreal.
Benjamin Main from CKEXU in Lethbridge brings us our next headline about Tibetan National Uprising Day.
This is Benjamin Main reporting from CKEXU in Lethbridge, Alberta for Groundwire Community Radio News. I am joined by Setan Drahu, a lifelong Tibetan human rights activist. Tibetan National Uprising Day took place on March 10th across the country and around the world. Setan, can you tell our listeners about this International Day of Action?
The China's People Liberation Army took Tibet by force in 1949. They invaded Tibet and they did not leave. So on March 10th, they were going to say get out of their country.
So has this been something that's been carrying on year after year since then?
Initially, it was a memorial for the Tibetans that lost their lives and for the Tibetans that still stayed in Tibet to keep things going.
So how can folks get involved with this issue if it is something that resonates with them?
All the Tibetans know what to do now is they're doing a peaceful protest and to peacefully demand, right? So now that's not working. And this is where people can step in if they want to take action, is the message that 137 Tibetans since 2008 have self-immolated. We can right now at this moment, at least in this moment, speak freely without worries of being thrown into jail, disappearing, having your family members disappear. So let's speak out for the Tibetans that are killing themselves by demanding, I don't know, using social media, public outcry, you know, calling China's shame on what they're doing to human beings happening around in this world. And it's really interesting because they are a member of the United Nations, so we're stuck. They're a big power. What can we do? Well, power of the voice. Just doing this radio clip right now, I think, is effective.
Next, Aaron Bond from CHSR in Fredericton brings us this report on the medals that will be awarded at the upcoming Pan Am, Parapan Am Games in Toronto this summer.
The 2015 competition medals for the Pan Am and Parapan Am Games were revealed on March 3rd at the Royal Ontario Museum in Toronto. The Pan Am and Parapan Am Games are a major sporting competition held every 4 years with participants from North, South, and Central America. Toronto-based Barrick Gold Corporation sourced metal from mines in three Americas to produce the 4,000 competition medals crafted by the Royal Canadian Mint, which will be handed out to the 7,000 athletes participating in the games that run from July 10th to July 26th in Toronto. Designed in consultation with Métis artist Christine Belcourt, the medals were inspired by water, and according to the Pan Am website, they are to express the values of inclusion and diversity and highlight Aboriginal traditions of welcoming guests and the cherishing beauty of the natural world. Belcourt shared this written statement with Groundwire. The design element I feel most strongly connected to is the part that represents the water. Water is sacred. We are polluting our oceans, rivers, streams, and lakes at an alarming rate. If something is not done about it, we as human beings on the planet are headed for a disaster that will threaten life on Earth. I also thought about the hard work the athletes put into training, how water connects us not only by the waters that surround Americas, but the water they will consume to train well. Water is what truly unites us across the globe. I'm thankful not only for water, but to water for always giving us life and sustaining us. Activist Sakura Sanders, author of the article titled Unveiling Metals, Veiling Abuse, A Profile of the Mine Sourcing Pan Am Metals on protestbarrack.net, believes that there is a counter-narrative that should emerge from the Games.
There is a counter-narrative that should emerge from the resistance to the Pan Am Games. The government spent a lot of money promoting these games that should have been spent on social services. Throughout the Americas, what I would like to see emerge from the Pan Am Games, especially with a focus on Barrick Gold supplying the medals for the Pan Am Games, is Pan Am resistance to colonization through Canadian mining.
This is Aaron Bond reporting for Groundwire from CHSR on unceded Maliseet Mi'kmaq territory in Fredericton, New Brunswick.
Up next, Michelle Burke from CKCU speaks with Ottawa local Gabriel Fayan, who was presented with an Inspire Award for Extraordinary Indigenous People in Canada 2 weeks ago.
2 weeks ago, on February 27th, the outstanding accomplishments of 14 individuals were acknowledged at the Inspire Award Ceremony in Calgary. The awards are organized by Inspire, Canada's largest not-for-profit funder of Indigenous education, and recognizes the achievements of Indigenous people in a wide range of disciplines. This year's laureates include Kendall Knitmaker, an entrepreneur from Sweetgrass First Nation in Saskatchewan, who started a clothing brand and has gained worldwide recognition. Jordan Koenig, a CBC video journalist from Arviat, Nunavut, and Gabrielle Fayon, a grassroots activist based in Ottawa. My name is Michelle Bork, and I spoke with Gabrielle about her achievements.
My family comes from Fishing Lake Métis Settlement in Alberta. I've been living here in Ottawa for about over 10 years now. I came here when I was in my teens. And I am the co-founder of Assembly of Seven Generations, a youth-led and youth-driven organization. We've been working on Assembly of Seven Generations for... the idea came around just after Idle No More. That's where the kind of the fuel came from.
Can you tell me a little bit about some of the ways you've seen your work have an impact in the community?
Sure. So I've definitely seen the young people take up more of a leadership role and go back to those ceremonies, and many more have been coming to the drum and they start singing, and you know, they're proud to be Anishinaabe or Indigenous.
We go now to a headline from CKUW Radio in Winnipeg on Bill C-18. Michael Welch brings us this report.
On Friday, February 27th, the Federal Agriculture Minister, Jerry Ritz, announced in Winnipeg that the Agricultural Growth Act, Bill C-18, had received royal assent in the Canadian Parliament 13 months after it was first introduced. Bill C-18 is an omnibus bill that affects several federal agricultural laws. At the core of the bill is a convention known as UPOV 91. UPOV stands for the International Union for the Protection of New Varieties of Plants, and 1991 was the late year of the latest revision of the convention. The thrust of UPOV 91 is the protection of new varieties of plants through an intellectual property right. The National Farmers Union is critical of the legislation. Dean Harder is a representative of the NFU. He sees Bill C-18 as primarily benefiting major agribusiness corporations.
What we've seen more and more, if you're bigger, you have a bigger, you have more room to play than you are if you're smaller.
Meanwhile, small producers are restricted in the way they can save and use their own seeds.
It doesn't say that you can sell or exchange that seed. Understand, UPOV 91, for those seeds that are registered under this Plant Breeders Rights Act, they don't conform to our traditional standard of saving seed.
From Winnipeg, in the heart of the occupied Anishinaabe Aking, homeland of the Métis and the traditional territory of the Nihoak and the Nakota, this is CKUW's Michael Welch for Groundwire.
That's it for the headlines. We'll be right back after this. Now it's time for our feature stories. The City of Montreal recently dropped nearly 2,000 charges against protesters brought under the city's controversial P6 anti-protest bylaw. CKUT's Antoine Cadeau has more from Montreal.
You just heard sounds from the March 5th demonstration in front of the courthouse in Montreal. Last week, the city of Montreal dropped nearly 2,000 charges related to the controversial anti-protest bylaw P6. Those who had their charges dropped were mostly arrested in mass and ticketed in protests between the student strike of 2012 and 2014. Even though the constitutionality of P6 is currently being challenged, the bylaw is still on the books. However, those who had their charges dropped no longer face hefty fines of over $600 just for having attended demonstrations. The CKUT News Collective wanted to get the reaction from local protester Jaggi Singh and Kevin Paul, but also covered the March 5th court hearing for the examination of all the other cases.
It's a decision that represents a huge defeat for the city of Montreal and really an admission that P6 is totally broken as a municipal bylaw and as a means of shutting down demonstrations. And it really testifies to the efforts made to the collective networks of support that have been developed by the protesters charged, who have been, for the most part, self-representing through this process. So these are people with no formal legal training who are sharing skills and experiences and knowledge as they go through this process. And that's, I think, one of the most inspiring aspects of this for me is that the city here, we're talking about over $1.25 million in lost revenue simply in the ticket amounts. And this has come about through a really inspiring process of collective self-defense.
I think ultimately the defeat of P6 didn't come from necessarily any judgment or any judge. It came from defiance in the streets. Now, ultimately, there was a good judgment, and that judgment led to basically thousands of tickets being withdrawn and people being acquitted. But keep in mind, that's in the context of hundreds and hundreds of protesters at dozens and dozens and potentially over hundreds of protests defying the P6 bylaw. Because what the P6 bylaw does, and what it's always done, is basically given the police a green light to mass arrest people whenever they want. What this defeat does, I think, is provide a little bit of motivation for people who might have felt scared or fearful of being in those demonstrations. It provides them with a little bit of motivation, knowing that ultimately the things that people were arrested for were defeated, and allows us to take those streets again. And I think we can defeat P6 definitively by never giving demo routes, by never collaborating with the police in advance when it comes to protests. It would be a bit, I'll use a strong word, it's a bit pathetic if P6 becomes an end in and of itself. P6 simply was something that got in the way of us being able to do other things effectively, which is to demonstrate, which is to talk about these issues that we care about. So I think ultimately the best way to defeat P6 is to use street protests as a tactic for these radical movements that we're part of.
This is Antoine Cadeau on CKUT 90.3 FM reporting from Montreal for Green Wire.
Our next feature is about the National Day of Action against Bill C-51, which took place on March 14th. People across the country rallied against Harper's proposed anti-terrorist bill.
The Harper government's Anti-Terrorism Act, Bill C-51, has generated significant opposition from social justice groups, environmentalists, indigenous groups, Muslim organizations, and from legal experts, and even from four former prime ministers. Saturday, March 14th, was National Day of Action against Bill C-51. Public actions were reportedly taken in no fewer than 70 communities across the country. The following is some of the sounds from three separate communities. First, we hear from the protest in Toronto with audio recorded by Victoria Fenner of rabble.ca.
If we're going to talk about terrorism based on the very root of its meaning, then the first people they should be going after under Bill C-51 is the Harper government. I'm glad you agree. Because as far as I'm concerned, I've never killed, oppressed, or tortured anyone. And I really can't say the same for them, for their policies, or for their allies.
In Montreal, Anouk Millette for CKUT recorded this audio.
We're fighting C-51 because it's an anti-democratic bill that allows the government to access all the information and share it within the different government instances.
What is so anti-democratic about it?
Just the fact that the Privacy Commissioner of Canada can't even bring his testimony at the hearings that are happening right now.
What is your agenda for today?
Just marching, making as much noise as we can on social media, on the street, getting as much people as we can out here. Then we're going to get to Trudeau's office. We're going to hand in a petition with 84,000 names. So that should show him that Canadians are against this bill.
We have a right to confidentiality.
Yeah!
We have a right to protest what we believe is wrong. That being said, we do not need permission to fight against policies that our government puts in place that go against what is right.
La liberté, c'est un droit inaliénable!
Donc, ce que je disais dans le fond, c'est que nous avons le droit de manifester.
On a bright, sunny spring day in Winnipeg, over 400 people showed up outside City Hall to make their concerns about Harper's secret policing bill known.
Harper has undermined the ability of your elected representatives to act on your behalf in the House of Commons. You have to take it to the streets. You have to. Sometimes civil disobedience is civil defense. And brothers and sisters, there has never been more justification in this country to show civil disobedience for the civil disobedience.
Industry like tar sands expansion, fracking, logging, mining. It's these resources that money-hungry government, corporation, and foreign interests are after. They will try to stifle dissent, but they will not succeed. Our people are determined to assert jurisdiction in the name of protecting land, waters, our climate. We never gave up our rights. We never ceded these lands. Our ancestors are walking with
people's
us.
Rights from across Canada. And people like myself, a raging granny, would now be on a list of potential terrorists. And it's a scary proposition.
So we have things that we have to go from here and do. It's not just about showing up here today, but thank goodness you all did. Let's give a big round of applause.
March 8th was International Women's Day, and women took to the streets around the world to celebrate their opposition to patriarchy and sexism. From the streets of Montreal, CKUT's Leonie Carwat bring us this report.
For the International Women's Day on March 8th, women of diverse origins called to join their march in downtown Montreal. Throughout the demonstration, voices are pointing at two major issues. Firstly, austerity is a feminist matter, since women are particularly affected by the measures. And secondly, the struggle is international. There is a need for solidarity that includes perspectives of all women fighting oppression. An emphasis is put on migrant workers, racialized women, and those affected by colonialism. The anti-fascist collective Montreal Sisterhood organized a radical feminist contingent against austerity in the march. They talked to me about their fifth anniversary, sexism in alternative scenes, and their motivations to form an all-female group.
Le Montréal CCO se crée là, 5 ans maintenant. Notre objectif est de politiser les scènes contre-culturelles, que ce soit hip-hop, hardcore, reggae, oi, punk, etc.
Différents constats que nous avons faits lors de la création du Montréal Sisterhood. Un des premiers constats, en fait, c'est que les femmes étaient souvent moins considérées que les hommes dans la lutte. Donc, par exemple, au niveau des tâches, nous avions souvent les tâches plus logistique ou organisationnelle et moins les tâches visibles, comme par exemple les femmes sont moins présentes au niveau des tâches de porte-parole, de représentation média, alors que nous sommes plus à l'organisation des événements, derrière le banc, derrière l'étape de marchandises, etc. Il y a aussi un deuxième constat qu'on a fait qui est par rapport à l'image des femmes dans notre milieu. Donc, même si on a un milieu qui véhicule des idées égalitaires, on se fait encore appeler la copine de machin ou bien la fille de tel gars. Et aussi, on entend quand même des commentaires sur notre physique. On est jugé par rapport à notre potentiel sexuel. Donc, ce sont différents constats comme ça que nous avons décidé de nous organiser pour faire un peu un contrepoids à tout ce sexisme vécu. Nous voulons démontrer que si nous sommes contre le patriarcat qui divise hommes et femmes, nous sommes aussi contre l'austérité qui divise les classes sociales. Donc, c'est pour lutter pour plus d'égalité sociale. Ça, on pense que c'est une lutte progressiste qui va de pair avec le féminisme.
At the march, I had the chance to speak to Alexa Conradi, president of the Fédération des Femmes du Québec. She's giving more insight into austerity's effects on work and living conditions of women.
So the austerity measures have many different impacts on women. One of them is to make it more difficult to access public services because in many regions of the country or of the province, people will have to pay to have access to speech therapists, school, special education services in schools. Also, there's an increase in fees for daycare. There's increase in hydro, and then there's also a decrease in services like social housing. And women are the main renters. And then also women tend to work very heavily in industries, in areas like public services, social services, the care industry, and in education. All areas that right now are being cut back. So the workers in those environments are seeing their working conditions worsen. So then there's an issue with also the increase in unpaid labor that women will have to face. So we're still primarily the ones to look after the people who need care. And as the government cuts back on these services, they're still needed. And so we're going to basically, under austerity measures, see our lives with more work and less money. And already there are 1.5 million women in Quebec who make less than $20,000 a year.
Further, speeches criticize the politics of social welfare.
Qu'on réalise quand on travaille en alliance avec les personnes assistées sociales, c'est que les situations de vie où on peut réellement faire un choix quand on est à l'aide sociale sont vraiment limitées. Je ne sais pas trop comment parler de consentement quand il n'y a pas de choix. Le calcul a été fait des millions de fois, puis un chèque d'aide sociale de 615 piastres moins un loyer de 500 quelques piastres. Ça ne laissera jamais assez d'argent pour la vie.
The final speech of the march addresses the issues of Filipino care workers. They are threatened by changes to the Life and Caregiver Program.
The caregiver program has evolved and changed in the real essence and principle behind. In the past year, the federal government made changes to the temporary foreign workers program. But all this tantamounts to one thing. The temporary workers and caregivers will never get permanent residency. We need a place where women are valued and protected. We can only achieve this if we hold tight together, be firm on our principles, and move ahead with our rights. Let us not waste time. Let us build the world we want now.
This is Leonie Carvat reporting from CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal.
Now it's time for our community radio report. In this week's community radio report, we'll hear from Brian Cleveland at CFMH Radio in St. John, New Brunswick, who is hosting the annual National Campus Community Radio Conference this coming June.
My name is Brian Cleveland, station manager at Local 107.3 FM, the campus-based community radio station in St. John, New Brunswick, on the beautiful Bay of Fundy, board president of the National Campus and Community Radio Association. And we're excited to be hosting the conference of the organization in June. And it is a very exciting time of year for community radio folk all across the nation who come together for a week-long experience of collaboration, learning, and, of course, sharing in good food and having lots of fun as well. But it's a very reinvigorating event for a lot of community radio employees and volunteers and programmers from all across Canada. Anyone can attend the conference. We're particularly hoping to really invigorate our community about not just community radio, but there'll be topics about volunteerism, about the resources that people can utilize, about mental health and wellness, risk management, and many other topics that would be relevant to people from all walks of life, but certainly mostly the majority of the individuals coming would be people who are members of the National Campus Community Radio Association member stations, but it is open to all individuals, and that is also especially the case with all the events that we'll be hosting in the evenings. We have now open registration. Early bird registration is a little bit cheaper than the regular registration rate, and it will run until April the 30th. Organizing lots of workshops, both from our members and outside of our membership. We're also organizing lots of music events, and we've been able to secure some interested parties to help sponsor the conference. We're just under 3 months away. The weather is starting to get a little bit nicer here after a pretty crazy and wild winter. Generally, every year at the conference, some of the greatest times happen out on a boat. That's been the case in most of the NCRCs that I've been to, and I think that probably the main reason for that is that there's always so many different events and workshops going on that it's pretty rare that we get every single attendee in the same room or in the same space. And so we have rented space on the Voyager 2, which is a Mississippi River boat built in Louisiana and holds about 100 passengers, and it's going to go on a 3-hour river cruise through the St. John and Kennebecasis Rivers, and we'll also have some food there and also have some music on the boat. You can find more information on our website, which is localfm.ca. There is a tab in the links portion there that will take you to the NCRC 2015 section, which you can also get to on your own by going to localfm.ca/NCRC2015, or you can also get there by going to the National Campus Community Radio Association's website, which is ncra.ca.
That's it for this edition of Groundwire, produced by Ophira Harwitz and CKUT. Headlines this week were written by Benjamin Main, Erin Bond, Aaron Lekov, and Michael Welch. Groundwire is a project of the National Campus Community Radio Association. For more information or to hear previous episodes, visit groundwire.ncra.ca.